Today is Thursday, February 17th, 2021 at 1:40 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record via Zoom throughout Chicagoland. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Neil Steinberg, columnist of the Chicago Sun-Times.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Eric Zorn, still employed as a columnist at the Chicago Tribune.
Glad to hear that, Eric. Glad to hear that, Lisa. We'll talk a little bit about media in this town in just a minute. Let's start with Mike Madigan, though, shall we? He is walking away from his position as a member of the Illinois State Legislature while he... I don't think that worked. Austin literally timed it so that when I said that, he popped a beer, and he's now taking a sip of it.
Happy Independence Day, everybody.
Okay, so he lost his position as House Speaker earlier this year, but still a representative for the people of the Southwest Side. But that wasn't good enough. I said something like that on the radio, and Steve Bertrand just sort of clucks his tongue and goes, "You're so naive. People of power never keep the little position when they lose the big position." I get it. But I'm a Pollyanna, and it seems to me like they elected you to represent them. And then the icing on the cake was that you were this all-powerful god. But it still seems to me like you should serve out your term and represent the people. But, of course, that's not what Mike Madigan wants to do. So he's walking away. Is anybody surprised?
I was expecting him maybe not to run again, but no, I'm not surprised, because he even gets the power by resigning now to handpick his successor. He'll be the decider.
Well, he clearly didn't want to be what they call in Springfield a mushroom. You know, one of the people, the backbench legislators they keep in the dark and feed manure from time to time. And so there was no reason for him to stay. I think he didn't get, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think he got any committee chairmanships or any real good assignments. So there was really no reason for him to commute back and forth to Springfield. He maintains his position as the chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party with all the money and power that comes along with. And he doesn't have to go back and forth and be a meaningless voice in the back of the room. So I'm surprised it took him that long. To me, this seemed like really just an incremental step between his resignation as speaker. Well, he was forced out, but he resigned as speaker. And presumably or possibly his indictment on corruption charges. But this seems to me to be a very small turn of the wheel. Am I getting any disagreement on that?
No, I think there's good reason to think this could be part of a goodwill gesture toward the feds. You're going to resign your seat and be able to cut a better deal. That's complete speculation, but that's happened in other corruption cases, not just in Illinois, but in other states.
I also wonder whether he held as much power as or more than even the governors, even the Democratic governors. I also wonder if he in his final acts here miscalculated things. You know, after the election, both Pritzker and Senator Durbin kind of hinted very publicly that, hey, we lost some things here in this election because of you. And I took that as because of you as the Democratic Party chair. And I thought they were trying to get him to sort of step aside as the party chair, not to step aside as a lawmaker. And so in the end, he sort of loses out on, you know, he runs for office again and then is ultimately sort of forced, you know, to hand over his crown as the speaker, and now he's leaving under a cloud. And I just wonder if that was a miscalculation sort of on his part in the end.
Mm-hmm. What are you thinking, Neil?
I'm thinking, what are the Republicans going to do as far as like a AOC fear figure? You know, Madigan was such a nexus for their, you know, for their hatred and fear, that with him gone, who are they going to find? I guess the governor, right?
They did start a Fire Pritzker campaign just this week, right? Hashtag Fire Pritzker.
Pritzker's really despised, you know, from people who have bars in LaSalle County and things and don't understand why they can't keep them open. Again, I've never, you know, Madigan to me is a complete mystery. I never quite understood why he wielded power. I never understood, you know, the fascination. You know, he's down in Springfield where he's out of mind. I'm glad he's gone. He's 78. He should retire or something, golf or something. But I guess to do what he did as long as he did it, you have to be some sort of monster who lives on, blood and power.
He's part of this last sputtering part of that old school Democratic machine where there was this mystique. He rarely stepped out in public to talk to reporters, but he held this power in Chicago. And I think that people bowed to it and continued to bow to it, especially people who, kind of owed their political rising to them. Him being in charge of the Democratic Party sort of made him the ultimate ruler, because he did decide everything from who could run for, or who was going to get the money to run, at least for, this aldermanic seat or this legislative seat, Democrats, of course.
That's a key part of what Neil said is that it would be folly to think, I'm sorry, I'm three sips into this beer. It would be a folly to think that removing the face removes the problem. The thing about Madigan is that he accumulated power through these failed and corrupt institutions that we now find ourselves having to deal with at the state and local level in Illinois. One of them is his political power base and his patronage army was built on the pension system. And nowhere is that more evident, and nobody say this outside of this room because I think we're trying to pitch this as an exclusive somewhere, but his pension goes up, I think, to $146,000 a year after year one because of a pension sweetener. Over the next 15 years, he's going to take home around $2.8 million if he lives that long in pension benefits. He's contributed around $300,000 to that same system over the course of his career. The reason he has the weighted vote to pick his successor is because he drew the political maps that way to include the 13th Ward. More than one corruption conviction per week since 1983 in Illinois is the result of not passing any significant ethics reform. And it is now incumbent on Speaker Welch, on Senate President Harmon, and on J.B. Pritzker to fix these institutional issues. There's no excuse anymore. You don't get to, Republicans don't get to have this great boogeyman, and Democrats don't get to just say, it's whatever Madigan wants. It's mm-hmm. incumbent on them to fix this.
I wish I had more good things to say about him. Like on the radio, Austin, I've called you. I've talked to all of you on my show, but Austin was on today talking about Madigan, and I don't have a go-to person to say, yeah, but.
He adopted Lisa Madigan. She turned out okay. She could have been governor had he let her, but he refused to step down then. In fact, I remember having lunch with her, and she was thinking about running for governor. And I said, well, you're going to have to deal with your father. And I said, so here's your line. When you announce it, you say, I'm very supportive, and he's my dad, and I love him. And then lean into the mic and go, but I was adopted.
Was she really?
Yeah. He was a foster father. He married his mother after she was born.
Okay. If you look at the way he consolidated, if you look at it from the Democratic point of view, he managed to consolidate power in that party and give them supermajorities in both chambers. We got rid of the death penalty. We increased gay rights. We increased the minimum wage. There are a number of sort of progressive style reforms. At the same time, I can't gainsay what Austin mentioned about the pension problem. I mean, when people complain about the pension problem, I like to point out that we have had Republican governors for most of the last 35 years, and that a number of the pension problems of the pension were introduced and signed by Republican governors. On the other hand, Madigan has been there all along. He has been the Speaker of the House all but 2 years of the last, 38 years, 36 years, however long. He was Speaker of the House. He okayed these changes in the pension that have left us in this in the hole that we're in. So you can't credit him for certain things without sort of looking at the entire picture. And as Austin points out, and his institute points out, the economic picture in Illinois is not pretty, and it's not just totally a coincidence that it is. So any evaluation of Madigan's career as a legislator has got to include that.
I was thinking of you, Eric, and Austin when I saw JB's budget proposal summary in the Tribune today. It does not include a state income tax hike. Now, Illinoisans voted not to impose a graduated state income tax, in theory putting the burden of higher taxes on the well-off. And the fear was, since we didn't have that, that the only way we're going to raise the revenue would include a higher state income tax for everybody. But JB said, let's keep it at 4.9%.
I'm glad that the flat income tax isn't going up, and they were using that as a scare tactic to get people to pass the fair tax. I think Lieutenant Governor Stratton said, hey, we're going to hike it by 20% on everyone, and that'd be really painful. And hey, turns out that's not what they're going to do, because that is way too politically painful, which was the entire argument about that tax, which is it's more politically painful to have to raise the flat tax. That was a big part of Eric and my debate about it. But there are other things in that budget. I would say overall, it's a status quo budget for Illinois. There are a couple things that jumped out at me. One is the fact that he called taking away tax credit scholarships for low-income kids essentially closing a corporate loophole, despite hardly any corporate money going into that program. I thought that was extremely disappointing for a governor who's able to send his own children and who he himself went to elite private institutions to take away access to that same opportunity for low-income families in Illinois. I think that's unacceptable. There's also a business tax in there that is being reintroduced called a corporate franchise tax. This, I do not say this lightly, is one of the dumbest policies in Illinois history. It is a tax on so-called paid-in capital. We'd be only one of two states that has it. It punishes investment in the state, and it costs businesses more to comply with than their entire tax liability from the thing. It's really, really silly. It shouldn't be in this budget proposal. Then the final thing, we just got finished talking about pensions, but it has to be mentioned in this budget discussion. Illinois is spending around the same amount of money on higher education pensions as it is on higher education. That's the elephant in the room. The state government is becoming a pension system with a small social service arm attached to it. And yet there was no mention of that whatsoever. Not even like a little mention, not even like a, hey, we need to move forward and bring all the parties together and talk about this. Instead, it was sort of just complaining about Republicans.
It was just the opening, his opening bid. And, you know, I will say this about the this scholarship thing that Austin was talking about. Essentially, what that program does is it gives people a tax credit for giving money to essentially to send kids to private school. And what that means is that it's not a deduction but a credit. So it's actually tax money. It's taken off your tax bill. So you might as well have the taxpayers pay for it, which I don't support. I don't support taxpayers paying for private schools, and that's really I think what that's about. I don't know about this franchise tax. I never even heard of it. There was another thing in there that has to do with what the state reimburses retailers for their costs associated with collecting sales taxes, and they're putting a cap on that because that particular benefit was put into place back when, you know, people had to figure this all out by hand on little Casio calculators, and now it's all done electronically. And so this portion of the sales tax really shouldn't go back to the retailers. It doesn't cost them that much money to collect and remit sales taxes. Overall, though, the question is, how is it that if you remember Lieutenant Governor Stratton, as Austin said that we were going to pay 20% more in taxes, and Pritzker at the same time was saying there's going to be very, very painful cuts if we don't pass the graduated income tax amendment. And neither of those came to pass. And when you ask them about it, what they're saying is, well, because tax revenue, even in the pandemic year, was higher than we thought. And so we don't have to make and we're going to be able to borrow money, and we're going to be able to move things around. It does have the feel of yet another phony baloney budget where they're borrowing from Peter to pay Paul and hoping that you don't really notice that actually in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, we're going to owe a lot more because of the way they've kicked the can down the road. So in that sense, it's disappointing. One other thing about that, about the speech, he did take a big, strong whack at Republicans for apparently not coming to the table to suggest cuts.
Not raising the tax is almost a tax raise in a sense that you can't tax people who aren't here. And if you look at the population trends of Illinois, people fleeing is that, you know, a lot of it is perception. And if people think the taxes are going up, they might be more inclined to leave. I mean, Austin said something that echoed what I've said about the city, that it's going to become a vast pension fund that also puts out fires. I mean, this is just a trap that we've been flailing in for years. And part of it is the law doesn't allow us to fix it. Part of it is you've made these commitments to people who've spent their careers with the state and now are, you know, need these pensions to live, generous pensions. And kicking the can down the road seems to be all we can do. But at one point, there's going to be some sort of disastrous, you know, Gotterdammerung where this is going to have to come to some sort of conclusion.
I also think that the overwhelming, the voters spoke overwhelmingly, I should say, that they did not want this, you know, so-called fair tax, progressive tax. I think that was enough of a pull for the governor to say, okay, we're not going to do any kind of tax increase. I mean, he is a year away from mounting, I guess, what I would assume is his reelection bid, and introducing something like that right now, with all the other issues going on, trying to get the economy back on track would be dangerous. I also think that what we're not looking at here is that, and the governor's office won't discuss it. I've asked them multiple times, you know, what about this $7.8 billion that the right now is on paper that the state would get from the feds under Biden's COVID-19 relief plan? And they're like, well, that's not built into this. Well, it may not be built into this spending plan, this budget that he introduced, but certainly if the state even gets half of that, you know, I mean, certainly they've got to see that as cushion. I mean,
they do. I think that one of the issues there is this is one of the very seldom few good Illinois budgeting rules. They can't bank that revenue if it's not there.
Right.
So in terms of his proposal, so I think it makes sense that he didn't include it. If any of that comes in, you're completely right. All of these, like, quote unquote loopholes or new taxes should be completely off the table, because ultimately those are folks who are hurting, who we need to rebound very quickly and shouldn't be on the table for tax hikes right now, especially if there's a windfall of federal money, which it looks like there will be.
Right. But they may not build it in there. My point was sort of, I asked specifically, where could this money go? It may not be there on paper, but certainly you're able to sort of, the margins of what they're spending and what they're taking in are so narrow. You've got to believe that they are counting on that in a big way as a cushion. What is it, $47 billion in spending and 46 point something in revenue, or I'm sorry, I reverse that, $47 billion in revenues, 46 something in spending. So it's awfully narrow. And I just would be interested to see what they're going to do. Are we going to do a California and give low-income residents a stimulus check? Did you guys see that? California has its own stimulus check plan where they're sending low-income residents $600 checks.
That's a one-time, by the way, Lisa?
A one-time.
Yeah. Well, I guess some states like Illinois did supplement the unemployment benefits, but I haven't heard about a separate stimulus plan. In California, they're going to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, you know, all the talk about the stimulus, there is no stimulus plan. I think it's inevitable that it'll happen, right? Maybe in March that the federal government will give everybody something like $1,200. Is everybody in the room, this is a little bit of a tangent, but do you all think that's going to happen?
I'm not even sure if stimulus is the right word to use right now. It's more of like a rescue, right? That the money we're looking for right now is to rescue people who are really at the end of their ropes, right? People who are losing housing and losing their food and, you know, all and heat and all of the things that people are really desperate for. That we're not in a position where let's juice the economy right now, right? We're in a position of let's make sure that people don't fall through the cracks.
I mean, I sound like a broken record, but I have kind of pounded on this thing. It's not like I'm making a lot of money here at a newspaper, but I think that these dollars should be targeted to people who are hurting the most. who are out of work, who, you know, need assistance with childcare, because their kids are at home, you know, learning remotely, all of these things. I don't want to hammer the federal government for doing this, because, you know, at least they're making this attempt. I just wish that it was a little bit more targeted, these payments, and maybe bigger for people who really, you know, bigger payments to people who really, really need it.
Mm-hmm.
Or $5,600, you know, behind in the rent and so forth.
Well, I was going to say, if these were banks or automakers, the government would leap to help them. And I don't understand that just because it's individual citizens whose lives have been upended through no fault of their own, can't get the government to prop them up so they can still be around when the economy, you know, gets rolling again, and this virus, which the government themselves have booted as far as the response goes, is finally handled. The end is in sight with the vaccine. All we have to do is make sure that people are still around for it, and it just seems like a prudent investment. And you know, if it wasn't for the Mankian partisan politics we've got, no one would be discussing this at all. It would already be done.
Well, the criticism I hear is that more than half of the money that we send out in stimulus doesn't stimulate. It gets saved, or it pays off debt. It goes to credit card payments, or they pay off their school loan, but they don't go out and buy shoes and groceries. More than half of the money doesn't stimulate.
Well, your credit card bill, you'd have it taken care of. It stimulates you in the sense that you're able to charge things later. I mean, just because you don't go out and buy a boat, I mean, maybe because a lot of it does go to people like myself who, you know, who still have jobs. I mean, maybe they need to discriminate a bit more as to who gets it.
Well, that was Lisa's point, right, which is that if you change the income or the need threshold, you can then maybe target the money and maybe even give more of it to people.
Sure. But we're not going to do that. But that's not going to happen. There's no either ability or inclination to do that. I have not heard anybody say, OK, we figured that out. I haven't heard him say they're going to try.
Well, if Heather were here and not doing her job, like she begged out on today, if Heather were here, she would say that when creating these thresholds and qualifications complicates the situation greatly. And it's just much easier, faster, quicker, better to do it. And not worry so much about the.
How do you even know if it's quicker, faster? I mean, how do you even know that?
I'm paneling Heather. When she comes back, we will hold her feet to the fire on this.
Yeah, Lisa, why are you mad at Heather?
Yeah, Lisa.
Not, but I just wish you could back it up. How do we know that it's more difficult? We don't know.
Well, doesn't it at least seem that? I mean, 50 different states and 300 million people, and you've got to figure out who's earning what and who.
We're already figuring out a $75,000 to $150,000 threshold.
But that's a broad brush, too. I mean, that's a very broad brush. So all I'm saying is I do understand the notion that it's complicated, because you need to know not only what did they make in 2019 or 2020, but also how much less they've earned as a result of the pandemic.
So I think if you lowered that threshold, you would be getting at the people who are hit hardest.
Okay, so instead of 75,
is earning $40,000 a year, but has to sort of figure out how to toggle between that, their job that's probably frontline worker or essential worker, and having to toggle between that and figuring out childcare for their kids who are remote learning. I think you're starting to get at that. Just saying, oh, well, it's too hard on the government. No, it's not. They can do that.
I've been proposing from the beginning a helicopter drop of cash, which would be the lowest friction way, no administrative costs. I mean, you got to pay for the helicopter, but otherwise it's pretty efficient.
Film it as a Hunger Games kind of thing, Austin. You know,
there's a lot of content generation opportunities. That's
streaming,
right.
Streaming pay-per-view. I think people would love that.
I don't think they're mocking you, Lisa, but it sounds like they're mocking you just a little bit there.
No, I'm agreeing with Lisa's point, which is that it's not hard to do basic thresholds, and we should do them to spend money in a responsible way.
We are already doing thresholds. Like everywhere else, we sort of bow down to some people's opinions and not others. So
wait, and whose opinions are we bowing down to here?
The ones who yell the loudest.
We won't keep on this. I sit and listen to it almost every week.
No, seriously, Lisa, what are you talking about?
Let's keep going.
I will say this. Somebody said this week that they're tired of the millionaire lawmakers being parroted by the millionaire network broadcasters saying that it's too generous to give people $75,000 or $50,000. I don't even care if it's inefficient, to be honest with you. If the mistake we make is giving somebody who's making $74,000 $1,500 or $1,200, I don't even care. And I'm not bent out of shape if they save it. Like, that's such a vice. The inability or the disinterest in figuring out who deserves how much doesn't even bother me that much, to be honest with you.
I am telling you, you can lower that threshold to like 50 and give people more money. I know that people, like, I'm not bent out of shape about giving money, you know, to people at that level, whether you consider it high or low. I'm telling you, you could go lower and help more people.
I would subscribe to that idea that giving people more money and lowering the threshold or raising the threshold, or whatever the term would be, so that more money ends up with poorer people. It makes sense to me, because that money is more likely to be needed, really badly needed, and more stimulative to the economy if that's what we're looking for.
In general, this is going to be an interesting discussion with state and local government aid. And I think, agreeing with Lisa, the most efficient, I'm not sold on the fact that there needs to be another major stimulus. If you look at over the life of the re-up on unemployment and then plus the actual stimulus checks, there has been a lot of recapitalization of household budgets. And that's the reason why we see state and local government revenues being really healthy, because that stuff is taxed and people are spending that money and state and local governments are generating sales tax revenue, which is why it's concerning to me that the next discussion is around, to Neil's point about like these big institutional bailouts going to state and local governments. If you are concerned about individual levels of suffering, give the money to individuals. You don't need to funnel it through state and local governments, especially ones like Illinois that have may end up on the other side of this pandemic in better fiscal shape because federal taxpayers than it was before because of its bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That's not fair to put that on other Americans.
Sorry, I don't mean to be denser. You mean it's sort of like, okay, create some kind of grant money for all these various food depositories and just sort of let the money go straight to them?
Or to, I'm literally saying individuals.
Oh, okay.
Individuals' okay. Pocketbooks. Like, okay. Make the smallest, shortest line between the money and the person spending the money versus through huge institutions like state and local government.
Sort of like the tamale guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. They should hire him to give out the money. He's very efficient and moves through the
city. That's the conversation my wife and I had. Brenda said, hey, that's that guy we gave money to at Christmas. I said, we gave money to the tamale guy at Christmas? She said, yeah, because then he buys tamales and walks right up to a homeless person and says, here, have a tamale. It's like very efficient and it's organic. And it's like, hooray. So then we put him on the radio this week to talk to him, and he's still doing that. And people are helping him. I mean, now he has thousands of dollars coming in. He and another guy still drive around in a van. They come up to somebody selling tamales. They buy all the tamales. This is such a metaphor. And then they just come up to homeless people or organizations that are giving it directly to homeless people. But boy, have they cut out a lot of the costs and inefficiencies in between.
Oh, I was thinking of the Knight Ministry when you mentioned that. You know, they're not a lot of bureaucracy. They're arranging for churches to give food to people. And they got a big bus and they're driving down Lower Wacker Drive, you know, giving people antiseptic wipes and things. There are ways to help people directly. And I'm kind of with Austin in that, is that the government has the money. Let's put it this way. How have we reached this point? And the only reason we reached this point is because of the minimal support that the government gave out last year.
Would you have preferred more payments or just a larger payment? Should we have been giving $600 every month, $1,200 every month to everybody?
Yeah, because you know, you want certainty as a person. Say, here's a grand now, February's taken care of. Well, what about what's going to happen in March? It's better to get $600 every month and know that you've got some sort of base.
And if I may, that's what the economists say is the reason that people didn't spend it, right? The fact that it was not sufficiently stimulative is because people didn't think they could rely on it. But if they knew they had $600 coming every month for the duration of whatever, then they would have spent it, because another $600 is coming.
You oversee, you know, in Europe is they have baseline payments for people in unemployment, that sort of thing.
So let's talk a little bit about Adam Kinzinger for a second, who I guess we all knew was an odd duck. the Chicago area congressman, one of just three Republicans in the House to vote both to impeach the president and remove Marjorie Taylor Greene from her committee assignments. Turns out he comes from a gaggle of strangeness. 11 members of his family sent to him via his father a letter that begins, "Oh my, what a disappointment you are to us and God." And then, using the sort of punctuation and spelling that would make Donald Trump proud, they roundly rebuked him for his votes and his character. The letter ends with this: "It is now most embarrassing to us that we are related to you. You have embarrassed the Kinzinger family name." The New York Times story about this says of his posture in the Republican Party that he is, quote, betting his political career, that his future lies in disavowing the former president.
As does all of our futures. I mean, I think this is hugely important, John, because, you know, if Kinzinger ends up becoming president someday, it'll be because of that article. Because, I mean, speaking for myself, he was just some Republican turncoat who was sort of saying the right thing, but not on my radar. And then to see his crazy family trying to stick a fork in him in public, I mean, who doesn't have crazy relatives who we cringe at, right? It made him a much more real, in my view, a real dynamic figure that I kind of went, oh, go at him, you're doing the right thing.
I was curious about the wording of that, though, Neil. They said he's betting his political future, and I thought maybe he's voting his conscience. That makes it sound calculated.
That's the worst part of the media, and that includes like the New York Times, is they view everything politically. Okay, and if I pull a baby out of a burning building, then I'm thinking to my own personal brand and blah, blah, blah. And the idea that people are not betting their future, that they're probably ruining their future, given how in bed with Trump still from beyond the grave Republicans are, I do think that we see people who are actually doing the moral, decent thing, though being Republicans.
But he did vote with the president about 93% of the time. I don't know that that's informative here or not.
If there had been, I mean, if Ted Cruz was as Machiavellian as he was supposed to be, at least one Republican could be, okay, I'm going to be the anti-Trump senator or whatever. But I think the reality is their constituents are all as crazy as those people we saw storming the Capitol. And they realize that if they don't follow Trump's lead, they're going to get voted out of office, or they're going to get primaried from the even further right by some, you know, someone who does toe the line. And so, you know, I just think that they made a moral calculation and said, look, I'd rather be employed and betray everything I've ever believed in and everything the country represents than risk losing my cush political job and do the right thing.
I do think that there's some political calculation. Sorry. I do believe there's some political calculation in getting the word out. He had been criticizing Trump long before this, even longer than I think I understood. Go into the weeds of that New York Times story, and you hear from this Republican operative, Richard Porter, say that back in 2016, when Kinzinger was criticizing Trump, Trump went up to Porter and said, hey, if you run into Kinzinger, tell him blah, 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 what he can go do with himself. Porter relays this to Kinzinger. Kinzinger says, tell him he can go do the same. And so there's been this sort of push and pull for a while. And I have, you know, last couple of years, I have been writing about this. Everyone is saying, oh, well, he's all of a sudden come out against him. No, he's been criticizing him for some time now. He's just sort of tried to put it out there more. It probably doesn't hurt somebody who maybe thinks, okay, I may be getting mapped. My district may be getting mapped out. Maybe I'll look at a statewide run, and getting this anti-Trump stance out there probably would help me in sort of Cook County and the collars.
He's been denying now pretty strongly that he's going to make a statewide run.
Not next year, but at some point.
And of course, what may happen is that his district may be redrawn in a way that's disadvantageous to him, or maybe the Democrats will say, well, of all the Republicans we could draw out of their district, let's try to protect Kinzinger. But the problem he's going to have is he's going to be primary. He's already being primaried on the right. Lisa, how many does he have? Two candidates so far announcing against him? Two.
Yes. And
so there may be like four or five Republicans who are running to his right. If he were to try to run down the middle there, he might be able to win the Republican primary. Judy Topinka won the governor's primary in 2008, I think it was, or was it four, 2004, with 38% of the vote. She's moderate Republican. So it can happen if you thread that needle and enough people like Jim Oberweis jump in. And he's trying to lead this national movement, right? He's got, what's it called, America First or no?
No, Country First.
Country First. I have no real reason to doubt his sincerity, in part because of what Lisa said, is that he's not like he just decided to do this yesterday. He's been banging on Trump for several years now. You know, no one has made the case to me that he's a hypocrite about this. Yes, he voted with Trump. I think in the last Congress, it was maybe more like 85% of the time. But he's a Republican. He's a conservative Republican who was elected as a Tea Party Republican back in 2010. He's not just a Democrat with an R by his name. And so, you know, and most of the time he voted with Trump, that was pretty mainstream. I'm not going to vote for Kinzinger, but I don't think that he's, because he doesn't believe in the things that I believe in, but I have no reason to doubt his integrity.
I think the chances that he can win in a statewide gubernatorial election get smaller and smaller by the day, honestly. You got to remember how badly Bruce Rauner's action on, I can't even remember the bill name right now, but the taxpayer-funded abortion bill, and how much of the right abandoned him for that. And Jeannie Ives almost ran away with the race, and that was just in a one-on-one head-to-head. I totally get Eric's point of, hey, if you split the far right ticket among three or four people, maybe he has a shot. It's one thing, the behavior that he had, that Lisa was describing for the last two or three years. I think the doubling down on that makes it very difficult for him in a Republican primary, because the Republican voters who know Adam Kinzinger in Illinois only know him as the guy who hates Trump and is trying to take down Trump. And I don't think his brand has really been established besides that. So that's a tough message to take into a primary.
Although maybe in the next election that'll be the right side to be on, Austin. Maybe that's not
it
a
might
perilous.
Be, but I don't know if it will be with enough of the Republican base that goes out and
in his district,
Illinois Republican primary. Well, I'm saying in a gubernatorial
race. Right. Yeah.
So we're 13 months away from anyone voting in a primary. So a lot can change then. And I do think that Trump, I've said this before, is going to look smaller and smaller in the rearview mirror as we go along. And it may be that in a year from now, people go like, oh yeah, he was against Trump, but he believes in X, Y, and Z, and he seems
you're
like
an optimist, Eric.
Why do you say that, Neil?
To me, the idea that Trump is going to shrink, I was reading that Times piece about Michigan, and it's like this cargo cult where they're already just, making huge edifices of Trump and wishing him back. I mean, yeah, he's been sitting there down in Mar-a-Lago nursing his wounds, but I hope this is going to go away, but given how quickly it's filled up the oxygen and the atmosphere of everything for five flipping years, it seems optimistic just to hope it just stops because he's not present.
It's been pretty quiet lately, though, Neil.
This is a strange, sad, victimology kind of thing. Is I've actually felt grateful to Donald Trump. I've actually sort of felt, oh, thank you for the gift of shutting up.
Well, not that he gave it to you. That was kind of forced upon him, too, right?
I don't care. It doesn't matter. All I know is it's not like everywhere you look, it's been a blessing.
To Eric's point, I think that's the direction it's going to go. I think Eric is persuasive. If he's been this absent in 4 weeks or a couple of months, imagine.
It can be dangerous to take whatever's happening now and just extrapolate it on to forever. And so I'm not Nostradamus. I have no idea what's going to happen. But I'm saying it's more positivity than I could manage.
you're not used to this, are you? Well, just going back to the Kinzinger thing for a minute, another takeaway from the Kinzinger story and the letter that the 11 members of his family wrote to him is how they give Christians a bad name. You wonder who, quote unquote, are those people out there? They're Adam's 11 family members. These are the people who I only shared a little bit of their letter with him. I don't know if you guys have read it all the way through.
Yeah, I've gotten both.
It's pretty perfect, right, about Donald Trump is there for God and you are not for God and you are a socialist and you've been brainwashed by the media. It's all of that. And it's all wrapped around this sort of with this Christian bow. The last 4 years have been as injurious to people who call themselves Christians, whatever that means, as it has been to be young a Republican.
It's dangerous to think that this is just sort of people who are sort of, these, what I've heard sort of like, oh, it's these rabid Christians. No, I've heard from people who are, frankly, from, my home state of Nebraska, who might be liberal on some issues, but, and there is a dichotomy here, but they're liberal on some issues, but they take a hard line when they look at people's record on abortion. And I believe that that was brought up in at least one of those letters.
Oh, yeah, it was.
It's interesting to me how much the abortion issue is in the forefront of people's minds. That is like front of mind.
And also the hate issue. I mean, you know, I agree with you, John, that this indicts Christians. But you know, one reason I related to this letter is I have family members who are Jewish who support Trump, and Trump's Jewish supporters are either they're bigots or they're you know, they're knee jerk Israel supporters who are behind Netanyahu. I mean, you know, a third of Latinos are supported Trump. I mean, I'm just saying is he has a broad appeal to people who are fearful, ignorant, vindictive. I mean, to me, the cruelty, it's part of the appeal. It's like this really nasty guy wailing on people you hate.
That's an extremist view, because in talking to these folks, it's sort of like, okay, he's a bitter pill to swallow, but I'm going to vote for the person who is or presents themselves as anti-abortion. I believe at some point in his career, he didn't have a stance on it, but Trump is now billed himself as anti-abortion, and so he's a bitter pill to swallow, but that's who they're supporting.
Yeah, no, I'm not arguing with you. That's absolutely true. But I'm saying is there's lots of things like abortion. You know, for abortion is a wide swath of the electorate, and then there's other people who support him because he's a businessman. The paper sent me downstate, and I spent a few days talking to people in Fairfield County, and I came up with what I call framing. And it depends how you frame the issue. If you pick your political party based on their uniforms, well, you're a Nazi. They have great uniforms. I like to think that Trump is in the past in our rearview mirror and shrinking, as Eric says, but I still see him on the horizon and arriving. At least I want to be aware of that, because I don't want it to come as a surprise.
One thing that really interests me is that in all the discussion about Rush Limbaugh's death, that there has been a whole lot of discussion of how, you know, Rush Limbaugh was never really a policy guy. You would never see Rush Limbaugh doing debates with people about you know, about trade or immigration. He would never share the stage with anyone. And his conversations with his listeners was usually people calling and going, "Dittos, Rush, I love you," and getting him to espouse the sort of fear that Neil was talking about, that this was what Rush Limbaugh did. Was he excited people's fears and passions, and he wasn't intellectual, and in that way he really laid the groundwork for Trump. Trump is not a policy guy. I've challenged a lot of people who write to me and say, who do you think would win a basic like civics quiz between, you know, name anybody in Washington and Donald Trump? Trump and like Limbaugh, they were sort of ignoramuses in a way.
Yeah, I mean, that's why when people blame someone like Rush Limbaugh, oh, look what he did to us. No, we were that way, and he made $85 million a year, stroking our lizard brain and giving us exactly, you know, if he had given us policy, then he wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't have lasted the way he did. People don't want policy. They want to be told that the people they dislike are evil, and they're great.
Looking back on some of the Rush, I mean, I was not alive for the apex of Rush's career, which I would say is like the late 80s, early 90s. But he was a culture warrior and an entertainer, and he was an incredible entertainer. If you could get people to listen to you for 3 hours a day, that many people appealing to those instincts, as Neil said. And he was very open about that. He said, you know, I'm not even an activist. I'm not here to change people's minds. I'm here to get as many people as possible to tune into my show and charge usurious, I think he said confiscatory ad rates. Obviously, he's an extremely divisive figure, but if anything can be said that people can agree on would be his incredible talent in doing just that.
Yeah, I agree with that too. I think he was really a seminal radio performer. I think he was more like a stand-up comic than a policy wonk, and politics was his fodder. And that's why I always felt, what a wasted talent. I mean, he had all of that ability. I would like to wonder what it would be like if instead of saying the things he said some other things, but said them the same way, said them with the Rush Limbaugh snark, but wasn't so injurious to America. That sounds extreme, but I really think what a waste of talent. But the money is good. So this is what they do without any consideration for the consequences. That was Rush Limbaugh.
Did any of you catch that PBS? I think it was a Frontline production called The Great Divide. I've been thinking about that. They talk about sort of how Republican Party became fractured and the country became fractured in turn. But they really trace back, and I'm probably making this a little more basic than I should, but they trace back sort of this 80s and 90s sort of thing, basically people's career paths, especially in the Midwest, where you had a lot of people with sales jobs driving long stretches, driving sort of across region, and listening to talk radio, listening to Rush Limbaugh, and how a lot of people thought, well, that is news. They weren't just sort of taking it because we didn't have this sort of like, okay, you have either liberals, cable news, or you have conservative cable news. No, that wasn't there yet. So you wasn't around yet, especially I think in the 80s, people sort of kind of grew to think that he was sort of telling the news. And that's kind of how you started to sort of find these divides. People would be driving all day, they'd listen to it, then they'd come home and sort of see the news and be like, well, that's not really how things are. It's this way. You know, this is what Rush Limbaugh said today. And so you really started to sort of see how it sort of took away from sort of mainstream or neutral media, I would say, and diverted people into sort of this whole new world. And soon after that came Fox News. And so you kind of found this divide, and he's certainly created it.
We tend to be lapsian in the sense we think that, you know, over the past 40 years, we've had this divide. I mean, we had a civil war. You know, if you look at any part in American history, you know, before World War II, a third of the country would have happily sat it out if not gone on the side of Hitler. So, I mean, you know, the whole civil rights thing, you've got a big chunk of the country who doesn't want anything to do with any of that. And so I think that, you know, we rediscover this divide again and again and again. Maybe it's a basic divide in human nature. Either you empathize with other people or you empathize with yourself. If you empathize with yourself, you're Republican and everything's you and you're a victim. And, you know, it's not that you're a racist that's upsetting. It's that people call you a racist. OK, and you're willing to do everything except stop being a racist to make it go away. Yes, things make it worse, but there's going to be another Rush Limbaugh who's standing in for that. And if you look 50 years ago, I mean, maybe they didn't have the organization that they had, but there were the Hearst papers and there were all sorts of things that were always feeding that ugly American spirit, which we now see flourishing.
On the other hand, Rush Limbaugh, he did jump into the end of the Fairness Doctrine. He was the first broadcaster that really took advantage of the fact that broadcasters, after the Fairness Doctrine was lifted, I think it was under Reagan.
That's right.
That they lifted that, and suddenly you could put 3 hours of a right-wing bloviator on and not have to balance it with 3 hours of a left-wing bloviator. Left-wing bloviators just aren't as popular as right-wing bloviators.
Yeah, why is that, Eric?
And this, so part of it is the part of the brain that the right-wing bloviators appeal to. I think it's certainly part of it. There have been people on the left who have sort of tried to be that way. I don't think you can say people have been. Some people have writing me today saying, "Well, what about Rachel Maddow?" And, you know, to compare Rachel Maddow and Rush Limbaugh is not to understand what either of them do. Not that Rachel Maddow isn't a partisan, but she's not. She doesn't excite the same sort of passions in the same sort of way. Doesn't try to do what Limbaugh does.
I agree with that.
Anybody on the left. Very well known who does that.
I think if they could find one, they would take one, right? I mean, I think that's, I don't know what side of the brain you're talking about, but I think if there was that creature and it wasn't Al Franken and it's not Rachel Maddow and there was a whole network of them and none of them hit, is there a somebody like that on the left? And there isn't. I think that speaks to the uniqueness of Limbaugh's talent, not some part of the brain that he's appealing to.
We're doing different things. Listen to the conversation we've had for the past hour. Okay, we're talking taxes and policy and stuff. It's not the house is on fire, get the baby out. Okay, I mean, he's appealing to an emotional response. These armies of immigrants are coming over the border to rape your children. That's very different than we need to have a path to immigration. Okay, and so, you know, they're appealing to something and people want that. That's something that they give themselves over to. That's why, you know, when Trump was leaving, people were having this conversation of when are people going to realize he was X or Y? And I was always saying they're never going to realize that. Because you become invested in the fraud and it's used to define you. And that's who you are. And I think we're seeing that a lot. Speaking of which, I got to bail at this point. So, because I told my wife I'd go walk with her.
Go walk with her, and thank you for walking with us.
Anytime. Yeah. Fun, guys. Good talking with you.
That's Neil Steinberg from the Chicago Sun-Times. I want to pick it up here, though. I think that the comparison between Trump and Limbaugh is apt, right? I think both of them sort of reminded us of who we are, who's out there. That Trump wasn't the problem. We've said that before. He was a reflection of the problem. And Limbaugh captured that as well. Limbaugh wasn't the problem. And I do think there was something singular, why are you smiling, Lisa, about Limbaugh's talent.
I'm trying to sort of take it in because I do feel like it. I'm from a family of eight. We're all opinionated. I know that probably comes as a surprise to this panel. There were battles over things that he said, and is this true and that's true. Some of the things that sort of I was reminded of and reading some of the obits were things that were, I just sort of personally felt were dangerous, especially as sort of a college kid in, you know, in the 90s, when you would hear sort of a relative at Christmas sort of be like, well, how come, you know, why do you think that we need to have, you know, this equal representation, you know, in elective office? African-Americans are only 12% of the population. Here's this guy with this big platform saying these things that were morally reprehensible.
The parallel between Trump and Rush is really interesting. And the common thread is that if you can command audience, you can command mind share and you can win. And I don't think that's unique to the right. I do think it has a ton to do with a person's talent and thinking that way in everything that they do. I think the reason AOC, who would in normal circumstances be a total backbencher in Congress, has any type of heat is because she is incredibly gifted at communicating in new media and on Twitter, and she's on Twitch, and her Instagram is so blows up every week. And you see, like, on new media, like in podcasts, there's actually I think the most popular podcast on Patreon is Chapo Trap House, which is a Democratic Socialist podcast that makes millions of dollars a year because they command audience and they're really entertaining. And I don't think it's limited to the right by any means.
I agree with you. I mean, I'm not comparing AOC to, you know, or Limbaugh to Hitler, but certainly his communications machine was the biggest part of his, I guess, if you're going to call it success, that's not the right word for it, but certainly his ability to command a country and then start a war and kill millions of people. His success was his communications team. I mean, there people are still studying about how he was sort of able to sell the hate.
How much of that is just the projection of certitude? I've wondered about that because a lot of times when we analyze situations here, we'll talk about, well, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats have shared responsibility for X, Y, and Z, and we'll sort of try to weigh the equities in a situation. Trump famously never apologized, and Limbaugh, one of his big deals was that he was always right. You know, my talent is on loan from God, and that, you know, I've never make a mistake, and it's that kind of that just absolute certitude that I think people seem to find very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I mean, I think of it as a flaw that people who can't apologize, but it's actually considered a virtue by a number of people.
I don't know that it's virtuous. I just know that it works. I mean, it doesn't make him a good guy. It just makes him compelling to listen to. How many people listened to Rush Limbaugh, not because they liked him, but because they hated him? I mean, he got up going both ways. All four of us here seem to be relatively familiar with the Rush Limbaugh brand. I don't know that any of us subscribes necessarily to Rush Limbaugh's ideology, but by golly, it was working, wasn't it? People would listen regardless of whether or not they liked him. Let's talk about the Chicago Tribune for just a second. Eric, you sort of alluded to it at the beginning of our podcast today, and I don't know how deeply you can or want to go into it, but you talked to us on WGN Radio this week about Alden Capital, which will have a more commanding position at the Chicago Tribune.
Well, it's terrible news because Alden has been known for years as a company that comes in and it takes over newspapers and it just basically bleeds them dry and sucks all the profits out of them. It does not. It's not a journalism company. It's not a media company. It's a hedge fund, and they look upon someone making a newspaper like they would somebody making widgets, and it's going to be almost certainly very bad for the Tribune. People have been asking me whether it's time to unsubscribe to the Tribune in protest, and I've been begging them not to. So we need to show strength at this point. We need people to renew and subscribe and click and do all the things that, and you know, patronize our advertisers and do all that to show that we are strong, in hopes either that Alden realizes how important this institution is to the community, or better still, if there could be some sort of an angel investor consortium of philanthropic people or business people who would buy the Tribune, as happened in Baltimore, where a new not-for-profit was formed to take over the Tribune publishing papers in Maryland, and they're going to run them as not-for-profits there. That would be the ideal thing to happen at the Tribune, but it's bad news. If Alden takes over, and it's not dead sure yet that it's going to happen, but if they take over, these are not people you want running your newspaper. They're not people that you want employing you. And I feel really fine speaking out about this, because you know they're probably going to fire me anyway, right? I don't know how other people on the staff feel about that. A lot of people are younger. Like Lisa's a lot younger than I am. She might feel like, hey, you know, it's like better not make the new bosses real angry.
No, I worked at another paper that Alden would buy in St. Paul, Minnesota, and they've decimated that paper. That paper won a Pulitzer when I was there, and they've decimated it. And I need not look any farther or talk to my friends who are still there to know what they've done and how they value a newspaper and community news. If you want to talk about a newspaper that is connected to their readers, you can look at the history of the St. Paul paper.
Pioneer Press. Yeah.
Yeah. The Pioneer Press.
Well, it's a great paper. And Minneapolis is like Chicago in that it still is a good newspaper town. Great newspaper town. Two newspapers, viable, different, competing, pushing the not only each other, but the whole media structure. I mean, the same way everybody reads the Tribune and the Sun-Times in Chicago in the newsrooms, so too do they in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I wish that an Oprah Winfrey or a Bill Gates or a Griffin or somebody would have just stepped in and bought the damn thing. They could have done that, right, Eric?
Yeah, especially at today's prices. a daily newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, would be had for a pretty decent price. And we are still making money. Our union keeps pointing this out to people, which is like, it's not like we're bleeding red ink. We're still a profitable institution. And so the idea that we're absolutely circling the drain and people were writing our obituaries online on Tuesday night, that's not true. It's not true yet, anyway. So I think it would be, I mean, it might not be the best investment you could ever make right now, but it would be an investment in the civic good.
So. You suggested
and that's what happened in Baltimore, right? I mean, the Baltimore Sun was bought by a nonprofit entity, isn't that right?
Yes, all the Tribune publishing newspapers. There was there are, I think, three or four papers in Maryland the Tribune Company owned, Carroll County Times, and so on, that were taken over by this nonprofit.
Do you know the Bitcoin guy, Eric? That Lisa Austin. Do you know the Bitcoin guy? Who there have been stories about him lately. He made a video for Bitcoin about 10 years ago to help explain this new currency. They paid him with Bitcoin. He spent some of it, and then he kept 7,002 of the Bitcoin in a digital wallet, and then he lost the password to the digital wallet. This is about 10 years ago. That 7,000 Bitcoin that he has, 7,002 in that digital wallet, now it's about $50,000 a coin, is worth $360 million. $360 million. He does not know the password. He's tried it incorrectly 8 times. If you do it 10 times, it locks you out permanently. He has 2 more chances. He has no way of recapturing that. And the technology does not allow for it either. It's stored on a device that he can't find, and it was on a piece of paper he can't find, and presumably have been destroyed. $360 million. $360 million that will go poof. And that, frankly, it might as well. He has no access to it. So
are you bringing this up so that Lisa and I are not feeling quite so sorry for ourselves?
Well, he was an interesting conversation, because it's like, how do you wake up in the morning? Turns out he found another way to make millions of dollars. And by the way he does it is he's into the business of micropayments on digital wallets now. He said, okay, let's find another way to help fools like me, right? And so I was telling him about the Chicago Tribune on the air, and I said, you know, my idea is that you, if you don't want to subscribe to the Tribune or patronize your sponsors, you should pay per click. It's so easy to get through paywalls, or newspapers and radio stations don't even have them. Some do, some don't, and then there's ways around them. Use Print Friendly, for instance. So I said, why don't we have a system where I have a digital account, and every time I click on Google or YouTube or the Chicago Tribune, it charges me 1/100th of a cent or a dime or whatever the thing is. People were telling me the Tribune's too expensive and it's too thin and I'm not going to subscribe to it. I said, okay, don't. But you shouldn't get it for free because you say, oh, I don't like the Tribune. It's no good. You just read it online for nothing. You do value that. Everybody does. So why don't we have a system that enables them to capture just the tiniest amount for your free load and use? He said, that's what we do. That's what we're trying to build. He said, tell the Tribune to call me. I said, I'll tell Eric and Lisa later today.
Well, I agree with you. I have a situation, and I'm sure Lisa does too, and probably Austin as well, where like I'll be interested in a story like the Breonna Taylor story, the woman who was shot in Louisville, and I really wanted to read the coverage from the Louisville papers. I wanted to read, you know, whatever they had about that. I would go there, and I'd quickly run into the paywall that they have, which I understand completely. I understand why they have a paywall. I support the fact they have a paywall. I just wish that there were a way that I could get access to these stories for, you know, a dime a story, whatever,
right,
rather than in, you know, putting in all this information in and logging in and creating a password just so I can read a couple of stories from the Louisville Courier Journal. I think it's a great idea. I think if you had a passport that would you could go to any website and it would charge you, like I say, like you said, a micropayment, and that micropayment would then accrue to the site, so the people who are coming in to read stories, and I'm sure that the Tribune has the same problem when we have a big, for instance, the Jussie Smollett story. I'll bet there are people from all over the country coming in who wanted to read our coverage in Chicago, the Tribune and Sun-Times, about that story, and then they ran into our paywall and said, screw it.
No, I'm interested. I'd pay for the story, but I'm not going to pay $35 or $150.
You know, it's not that much, but even
for a year.
Maybe for a year, but if you just wanted a month or whatever, you'd have to sign up and you'd give them your credit card.
Right, but just ding, it costs you a nickel. Well, I got a nickel. What the hell? And I think people's inclination would be, wait a minute, every time I click, I'm going to get charged. Well, yes, you are. Maybe you'll be a little more judicious with your clicks now because it's free and it shouldn't be free. You should have to pay. And by the way, the amount you're having to pay, I'm going to say costs such a small amount that it's going to be another utility bill, but one you can manage. You can manage your media bill. Everybody's getting it for free now. And as a result, traditional media, upon which all these other ones are built, is suffering.
You have a guy get in touch with me and set up a meeting.
I'll have his people
call. You know a guy who knows a guy.
Yeah. Well done. Everybody support local journalism, support the Chicago Tribune, support the Illinois Policy Institute, and patronize the good people at WGN Radio and their sponsors. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Austin. Nice job, Eric. Bye, guys.
See you guys.
Thanks, everybody. See ya.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.